So last week we talked about a section of the Gakudo Yojinshu called The Necessity of Being Aware During Zazen. And I wanted to revisit an idea that we talked a little bit about at the end of the talk last week. The idea where Dogen says, "You must awaken to Buddhism right now. Above all, you must avoid presumption and choice. Reflect carefully upon this." It seems like a pretty important thing. I mean, he says, after all, above all. So, and part of that I wanted to talk a bit more about was the idea of choice. First, there's another quote from Dogen which I quite like, have it pinned to my wall next to my door as I go in and out of my room. Dogen says, "The determination to see things as they truly are, free from preconceived notions, results in the emergence of true practice." You've probably heard me say that before. The determination to see things as they truly are, free from preconceived notions, results in the emergence of true practice. This, to me, is right at the heart of what we're trying to do in meditation practice, in seeking the truth, in our determination to realize enlightenment, the mind that seeks the way. And it is quite, to me, a hopeful kind of, I phrase an idea, because it doesn't actually presuppose that we find the way that things truly are before we practice. It's only the determination to see things as they actually are. So there's an open quality to it. So in other words, for myself, I think to myself, okay, what I really want to do is see how things really are, where I'm fooling myself, where I'm distorting things, and just to see the truth of my life right now in this particular moment, moment by moment. What is actually true here? What is actually going on? And that determination, that wish, that will is our means of kind of clarifying what practice is, because it puts us in this place where we need to be willing to just let go of whatever our preconceived notions are, let go of our ideas about how things are, and just see how they are. This points to a mind which is both quite practical and mundane, but also deeply profound. There's an idea in kind of popular use where someone tells you to get real. And what they're asking you to do is face up to the facts of life, which are usually pretty unpleasant, and kind of let go of your spending time in la-la land and get down to the basic facts, you know, get a job, get real. And part of determining to see things as they truly are partakes of that quality, that quality of just being willing to see the ungritty, the gritty, unpleasant truth of life. But in the Buddha Dharma, when we say get real, there's also a quality of profound positivity about it. Because the basis of life, the basis of existence, the basis of reality is Buddha nature, which has the qualities of compassion, love, and wisdom. So part of our getting real from the point of view of practice both has that quality of, say, looking at the reality of karmic consequence, but it is also embedded in this much deeper reality of compassion, love, and wisdom. So there's a whole kind of different layer of what it means for us to be determined to see things as they truly are, to be determined to get real, is to also be open to the possibility that this very life, as it is, unpleasant as it may appear, or pleasant as it may appear, has the qualities of compassion, love, and wisdom within it. And our determination to see things as they are really looks into that, really sees the possibility of that. Now, to come back to this idea of presumption and choice, presumption is the side of it where we're assuming that we know how things are. We know how things ought to be. We know the real nature of things. We know we can see that they are a particular way, and we just take that for granted. That's where presumption is. And there may be some truth in our perception of the way things are. The challenge of it, or the problem of it, is that when we're in the mode of presumption, we're clinging to an idea of the way things are. And when we cling, we're automatically excluding the possibility of other things. Okay. So that's the presumption side, and that makes sense. We can see why we should avoid that. You know, it's just another set of opinions and views that we can work on letting go of. Now, the choice is another kind of, has other dimensions to it, is a more thorny kind of side of that. Why should we avoid choice? Obviously, choice is a profound part of the way things are. We need to choose what we're going to do. We need to make the choice about how we're going to lead our life. And we need to take responsibility for our choice. So it seems like he's telling us something contrary to what the rest of practice tells us. If we avoid choice, aren't we avoiding taking responsibility? Possibly, on some level we are. But I think what he's talking about here, the type of choice that we need to work on avoiding, is the idea that we can, in a sense, change karmic consequence. We can, through our choice, escape the consequences of our past actions and escape what they need to teach us, what they have to teach us. Let me see if I can explain this. In thinking about my work life, my life of working in the world, having a job, working with other people, earning a living, there was a thing that I would encounter with people because I was in the position at certain points in my work life of hiring and firing people, where I was looking at and studying what it meant to have a resume and what certain things about a particular qualities of a resume implied. And you would always, as an employer, be a little bit reluctant to hire someone who had gone through too many jobs. Because what it meant was, particularly over a short period of time, because it implied that there was something about them, possibly, that meant that they were not... they were not able to work things out with people. That when difficulty came up, they would quit. And, you know, you want someone who can, if you're hiring somebody, you want somebody who's going to last a while so that you can invest in training them and all that stuff. And you want people to have the ability to work with others and work things out. I'm not trying to give a seminar here on, you know, anybody on how to keep a job or get a job. That's not my purpose, and please, I'm just using this as an example. So there's a quality of that mind which will just quit when things get difficult, which is points toward the type of choice that Dogen is talking about that we should avoid. There is a verse from Bodhidharma who points toward, to my mind, Zen, the kind of heart of Zen practice, where he says, acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. This idea of just sitting still and accepting suffering is the right at the heart of what Dogen, I think, is talking about here, about avoiding choice. In a sense, we have the choice to seek something other than the suffering that is arising in our present life, to distract ourselves, to be pulled into external circumstances and try to escape the suffering that is arising, if there's suffering arising. And this idea of avoiding choice is to, in a sense, make the choice to just sit still and accept what is. To just sit still and accept the reality of life as it is. And to be willing to allow that to be there and teach us what it has to teach us in however that will manifest. And allow it to affect our life in however it will affect our life. This does not, to my way of thinking, stand against making decisions, taking responsibility, and choosing and making choices that need to be made. But it radically changes the way, the place within ourselves that we make those choices. It radically changes our relationship to the conditions of our life. It changes it from running, trying to escape, to sitting still, accepting, and making wise decisions about how to respond to what exists in our minds and lives. So there's quite a different shift there. And that quite a different shift is how we awaken to Buddhism in the present moment. It's how we bring to life the practice of the Dharma in the present moment. And it's what makes the practice of Buddhism something quite different from what we might call self-help in the world or self-improvement. Because it's not trying to change external conditions. It's addressing the root of our minds. It's changing the way that our minds actually are. And is harmonizing our bodies and minds with reality. It's harmonizing our mind with reality, with the truth of life. And that is a fundamentally different way of looking at the world. It's a fundamentally different orientation toward life than the kind of Western psychological model, where you can change conditions and you can make things nice for yourself. It's a completely different way of looking at the world than that. Not to say that Western model doesn't have merit and use. I'm not trying to exclude it. But what I'm trying to point out here is that there is a fundamentally different way of looking at life than that model. And to my mind, a way of looking at life which has, honestly, a deeper quality to it. That actually can make use of that orientation which wants to improve externals, but isn't tied to it, isn't bound by it. Isn't controlled by it. So to me, that sentence, you must awaken to Buddhism right now, above all, you must avoid presumption and choice. Reflect carefully upon this. This is a very important sentence and has a lot in it about our relationship to practice and about our relationship to our own mind. Does that make some sense? Okay. So then I'll move on to the next section, number 7. The necessity of Zazen when training to be free, when training to be truly free. Because of its superiority, Buddhism is taught by many people, but whilst Shakyamuni was alive, there was only one teacher, one teaching, and one teacher. By himself, the great Shakyamuni guided all living beings to complete understanding. Since Makakasho commenced the transmission of the truth, there have been 28 ancestors in India, 6 in China. The ancestors... It's an interesting thing. The ancestors of the 5 schools have, without interruption, transmitted it to the present time. Since the period of Ryokai, all really worthy persons have entered into Zen Buddhism, whether they were in the priesthood or of royal blood. One should love the excellence of true Buddhism rather than what passes for Buddhism. It is wrong to love the dragon, as did Sekko. Let's sort out these things here. Since Makakasho commenced the transmission of the truth, there has been 28 ancestors in India, 6 in China. Okay, what that means is down to 28 ancestors in India, that's all the ancestors that we recite up to Bodhidharma. The 6 in China are from Bodhidharma to Huineng. And there, things sort of dispersed. And there were a couple of disciples of Huineng who were quite popular. And things started to disperse into the schools, the beginnings of the Soto tradition and the beginning of the Rinzai tradition happened then. And that's what the reference to the ancestors of the 5 schools have, without interruption, transmitted it to the present time. He refers to 5 schools, and there are 5 different practices of 5 different schools of Buddhism, only 2 of which actually still exist. Okay. I don't know what the reference to "it is wrong to love the dragon as did Sekko." In some countries east of China, a web of learning, rather than true Buddhism, has been spread across the seas and mountains. Although it spreads over the mountains, the heart of the clouds is not within it. Although it spreads across the seas and the hearts, although it spreads across the seas, the hearts of the waves are destroyed thereby. Fools take pleasure herein. Such people are as those who would treasure a fisheye in the belief that it was a pearl, making a plaything thereof. To behave thus is to treasure a pebble from Jen as if it were a jewel. There are many who are ruined by falling into the hall of the demons. So basically what he's talking about here is the danger of thinking that our intellectual understanding of how practice ought to go, how practice should be, how practice is the thing itself, is the practice itself. In a way, each one of us recreates the Buddha Dharma from scratch when we begin. We start to sit and our teachers say, well, okay, sit like this and keep the precepts and here's the Dharma. Great, go for it. And each of us has to apply meditation to our own minds, apply the precepts to our own lives, and go forward in that place. And by doing that, we are, in a sense, recreating the path for ourselves. And it was only by following that meditation, following those precepts, that we're actually going along the path and finding out the truth of the Buddha Dharma. Our intellectual understanding of it can be helpful, can help clarify the subtle aspects of the path, but it is only through our practice of meditation, only through our practice of the precepts, that we prove it true for ourselves and that we make it real for ourselves. there's nothing wrong with, in a sense, intellectual study of the Dharma. You know, in a way, here's Dogen again kind of being grumpy. As long as we have that in mind, that the intellectual study of the Dharma is something slightly different than the actual practice of it, the actual creating the reality of it in our lives. And again, he's just kind of trying to make that point. Because it's so easy to think to ourselves, okay, I have a clear idea of what the practice is, so things are fine. I feel kind of okay, and I have a clear idea of what practice is, and I'll just be content with that. But what he's trying to say is, don't stop there, because there is a place where eventually we will regret having stopped, because our life will eventually completely fall apart. Our minds and bodies will completely fall apart. And we have the ability to sit still through that. If we haven't been practicing, well, it will be a lot more difficult. In a country in which there is much bias, the truth has difficulty in appearing because of the way in which it is beset by contrary winds. It's been thinking recently. I was reading a novel set in Thailand, and it was such a kind of relief to read a novel about a culture that has Buddhism kind of completely permeating it. You know, the people aren't any better than people in the West. It's not like they're kind of saints or anything like that. But they actually have the Buddha Dharma as their basic perspective. And even though they're doing, you know, kind of committing crimes and doing things to each other, they still kind of have faith in the Buddha, which is, it's just so, and there's no kind of argument about it. It's hard for me to describe. Being in the West, it's actually quite difficult to be a Buddhist in the West, because the whole kind of culture is completely, it's just alien in a way to the way that you can think as a Buddhist. And so you have to be constantly kind of constantly translating to another language. And in a way the West is a country with much bias. Although China has already taken refuge in the truth of Buddhism, neither our country nor Korea have as yet. Neither our country nor Korea have as yet had any real contact therewith. Why? At least the truth can be heard in Korea, but here it is not. This is because those who went to China clung to erudition. They seem to have transmitted the scriptures, but they forgot to transmit the truth. And again, this truth is the truth that we are kind of uncovering ourselves with our practice. What merit is there here? None whatsoever. Dogen's a little bit hard. Their failure was due to their lack of understanding of true training. How unfortunate it is that the body should be thus vainly employed in hard work for all its natural life. When learning the way, listening to the teaching of the master, and training after first entering the gate, there is something you should know. In the Ryo Gankyo, it says that external things control the self, and that the self controls external things. Should I control external things, then I am strong and they are weak. But should the external things control me, then they are strong and I am weak. From the beginning, these opposites have existed in Buddhism. The way that we control external things is, again, through this business that I was trying to describe with regard to choice. the way that we control external things is to sit still and let them go. They control us when we believe that we need them on some fundamental level. When we are entangled with them in the sense of having an unclarity about our relationship to external things. It is through just the continuous effort to sit still and keep the precepts that our true relationship to external things becomes clear. And in that sense, we are in control of them. They no longer control us. It's not that we can kind of, you know, control people or things, get them to do what we want. We might be able to do that, but that's not the point of it. The point of this control that he's talking about is that we can sit still and let them go, that they can just be there in their true perspective, which is just as an impermanent phenomena that will come and go. Even things like food, clothing, and shelter, we can sit still and not be controlled by those things. We need to recognize that we need them in a kind of physical sense, but they don't have to control us. And it is through the practice of meditation that we begin to learn that on a profound level. From the beginning, these opposites have existed in Buddhism. Unless someone has a true transmission, this cannot be understood. Unless a true master is found, even the names of these opposites are unheard of. Those who have no knowledge of this can never study true Buddhism, for how can they ever differentiate between right and wrong? And again, this problem of true transmission of finding a true master is just someone finding someone who knows deeply what the nature of these two opposites are. Someone who is proving for themselves that they are not dependent on external circumstances. They are not dependent on external conditions. In that sense, they are in control of external circumstances, not controlled by them. Or at least, they are, again, training themselves and understand the value of training themselves. We are all human beings, and sometimes we do get controlled by external circumstances. It is really there is a kind of quality where we can see where it doesn't, in a sense, matter whether we periodically are controlled by external circumstances, because we know that we're going to continue to train with that. Because we know that we're going to continue to apply that idea, the determination to see things as they truly are, free from preconceived notions, results in the emergence of true practice. So, for myself, I notice, oh shoot, here I am, those conditions which control me, whatever they are, and I'm being controlled by that. Okay, well, what's really going on here? How can I train myself in this situation? How can I sit still here? How can I keep the precepts better? What can I do? They who practice true Zen by studying the way naturally transmit the meaning of these opposites. They make no mistakes such as are found in some teachings. It is not possible to understand the true way without the training of Zen, without the training of meditation. And remember, the word Zen is just meditation. It's just meditation. So, that's what I have to say today. Any questions?
The first thing you read really struck home about presumption and choices. All the way here, I was thinking, you know, it would have been so nice to sit home and put a log in the fire and make some cocoa. What's the smell of all? It's so much easier. But also presumption, because you notice as I get older that the illusion that I could probably live to a ripe old age, healthy ripe old age, becomes more, it really is more and more the solution. And that makes you have to look at those choices a little harder.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not that we're trying to, in a way, it's not that we're trying to be morbid or kind of always, people complain about Buddhism because we're always talking about suffering. It's not like we're trying to kind of be in suffering all the time. We're just trying to kind of keep waking ourselves up, keep kind of saying, what is really going on here?
Yeah.
You know, because our all too often our human kind of habit is to just, kind of go to sleep and think, oh, everything will be just fine.
Yeah.
Get distracted by something. Everything will be just fine.
I'm still spending a bunch of time with my extended family for the holidays. And it's so interesting to have gone almost straight from Shasta Abbey to my in-law's house full of people. Because, like you were saying about living in the West, I mean, it's not that anybody is denigrating me. It's just, I was in this place where everybody valued peace and quiet, a calm, clear mind, and taking just responsibility for yourself being almost as much as you can really take responsibility for, and not worrying too much about what else someone else was doing. And in that setting, I could bring up something that maybe even could make someone uncomfortable, and trust that they were gonna try to meditate inside of that issue or inside of that question. And then the same behavior in a different context is like, I know, isn't that rotten? And people are, responding in a bigger way. And I brought up something kind of controversial in our family, which is my father-in-law's health, and because he's getting older, and he wasn't around. I probably shouldn't have brought it up because he wasn't there, and it's none of my business, really. But we all worry about him so much, and bringing that up really brought some strong emotions up in a lot of people around me, and I thought, oh, wait. What did I just do? I'm sorry. And they're like, don't apologize. This stinks. I was like, no, really. I'm sorry I brought this up.
It's just a difficult, just a difficult row that we have to hoe in a way. You just begin to. There isn't, in one sense, it's really important to recognize there isn't a difference between being at Shasta Abbey and being with your family. I mean, in terms of practice and meditation, and there's a way in which we just have to be so careful all the time, being Buddhist in the West, just to not, kind of get people set off in a way.
Yeah. Well, actually, in a way, it's a gift to us, because I'm pretty lazy. In a Buddhist society, I wouldn't have to be so careful. And when you think about it, training in Buddhism is, in one sense, it's always taking care. The Buddha was just always aware of what he was doing. So in that sense, he was always careful, although that doesn't describe it well enough. And so living in this context, we have to be. So we get training in something that I probably wouldn't want to have much to do with otherwise. And then another thing that's really kind of neat about it, we're getting an opportunity to translate Buddhism for a new culture. I mean, look what Reverend Master did. Just amazing bodhisattva work in bringing Buddhism to the West and in translating it so that even I can understand it, at least enough to get started. Which is kind of neat. And what my hope is that maybe in a couple hundred years, the West will actually have a feeling for karmic consequence. I mean, wouldn't that be fantastic? You know, just think about the change that could bring about in the whole society. Because it does look like the West is going to be, in some sense, kind of driving the world for a time. I'm not saying that we will necessarily be an economic power, but it seems like the Western ideas are really pretty, for a lot of people, they're very attractive. And this may continue for a while. So what we need to do is, you know, help the West find ways to look at it. And so if we can look at it from that point of view, you know, whenever I'm talking, I'm trying to make Buddhism work in English.
There's another quality to it, which is, it's pretty important with the whole kind of idea about preconception that we don't, there's a way in which the Buddhism, and this is different than the Buddha and different than practice, Buddhism can kind of have the idea that it has a sort of exclusive kind of monopoly on the right way to be. And I'm sure that this is probably not, you know, kind of, maybe this is heretical in a way. There's a way in which we as practitioners need to continue to be letting go of our preconceptions even when they're Buddhist, because a lot of times they are culturally conditioned ideas. And that's a really tricky place to be in, because in a sense you want to be quite careful not to both bring the teaching down to our level and not to water down the teaching, the Dharma, what is actually essential about the Dharma. So there's a kind of tricky balance going on there. And the history of Zen is actually an example of how that plays out in Buddhist practice. So in other words, when Zen came to China, it encountered Confucianism and Taoism. And those things both influenced Zen practice. But they influenced it in such a way that the practitioners of the Dharma, of meditation, were able to absorb that influence in such a way as to not water down the Dharma and actually expand it and actually kind of develop the practice. That requires this idea in the moment: what is really true? What is really going on? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
So go home and do it, yeah.